there is something where people are getting, I guess, misdiagnosed and too many labels, like the word narcissism is used a lot. And some people are not narcissistic. Some people have, you know, avoidant attachment, mm-hmm. and they have had a lot of hurt in their early lives, and yeah. they don't want to commit to someone. Just because someone doesn't want to commit to you doesn't mean that they're a narcissist.
Yeah.
But narcissist is one of those words that gets like slapped across everything. That's, yeah. Oh, you're a jerk. You're a narcissist. You yeah. know, like.
Today, I am joined by Dr. Judith Joseph, and I'm so excited about this interview. Dr. Judith Joseph, MD, MBA, is a board-certified psychiatrist with over 600,000 followers across social who follow her for her informative content surrounding mental health. She is the chair of the Women in Medicine Initiative at Columbia University and a clinical assistant professor of child and adolescent psychiatry at NYU Langone Medical Center. She has conducted several clinical research studies in pediatric, adult, geriatric, and women's mental health as the principal investigator of her research lab, Manhattan Behavioral Medicine. Dr. Judith is conducting the first of its kind research study in high-functioning depression and will publish a book on high-functioning depression with Little Brown Spark in 2025. Dr. Judith recently received a 2023 congressional proclamation from the U.S. House of Representatives for her social media advocacy and research in mental health. She has also made national television appearances on Oprah Daily's The Life You Want series, Good Morning America, The Wendy Williams Show, Investigation Discovery, The Today Show, and CBS News. She is a medical consultant for Apple TV, and her episode on high-functioning depression on the Mel Robbins podcast received record ratings. Judith, how are you feeling today?
Good. Aside from the weather, I'm great.
I know.
But thank you for the cozy tea.
Yeah, at least we have some tea to get keep us going. Okay, so before we move forward with the interview, I do have to make sure that you're qualified to be on my show. And to make sure that you're qualified, we do have to ask you one question, and that is... despite you being extremely knowledgeable in general in your life, do you know what you're doing?
You know, I tell all of my patients that, so I have so many degrees that I can't even hang them. And like, they're literally above my head in my office.
Yeah.
And like, I tell my patients, even with all these degrees, I still need therapy. I'm still figuring out, because we're all figuring out life for the first time. We only get one chance. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I don't know what I'm doing.
Okay, great. See, guys, none of us know what we're doing. Okay, so with that, we can move on. So I like to do a little rapid fire round in the beginning mm-hmm. to get to know Judith as a person. Okay, so the first question is, where did you grow up?
So that's complicated, because I was born in Trinidad, which is a tiny island in the Caribbean right off the mm-hmm. coast of Venezuela. But then I moved to New Jersey. And then for a while I was like enrolled in like Jersey schools and then Trinidad school. So
oh my gosh.
I'm kind of like this hodgepodge of Caribbean American, but I would say, I would say Caribbean American.
Okay. Yeah. You're like a third culture kid. Like, you're from right. lots of different places. Okay, cool. What did your parent or parents do for a living growing up?
So my father was a cop in Trinidad. But then when he came here, he became an ordained minister. So he had his own church. And my mother was a pastor's wife. So I grew up in the church, mm-hmm. like literally Tuesday Bible study, Friday prayer meeting, Saturday, sometimes some camps, mm-hmm. Sunday morning service, and then youth service. So it was like literally like a full-time job.
Oh my gosh. And you grew up to be a psychiatrist. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly.
Wait, that's so funny. Your dad was a cop in Trinidad, but then here he was a pastor.
My upbringing was very strict. So
I bet. Oh yeah, he's probably very protective. Oh very. My gosh. Okay. Did you go to college? And if so, what did you study?
So in college, I studied biology and chemistry with a concentration in neuroscience. I always knew I wanted to study the brain, but then because of the pastor's kid, I was a minor in religion.
Oh, did you have to, or did you just want to?
No, I wanted to. Like, I always questioned faith and religion and so forth, and I wanted to understand the root of my religious beliefs. Mm-hmm. But then that led to me understanding, I studied Islam, I studied Jehovah's Witness. I think I even studied like some of the voodooism in Haiti. So I studied all these like cool. religions that I don't practice because yeah. I was interested in faith.
Cool. Oh, that's awesome. And then you got a few more degrees after that.
Yeah.
You got just a couple.
So yeah, I didn't know what I wanted to, like when I started medical school, I thought I wanted to be a neurosurgeon because I did research in neurosurgery. And then I realized that those surgeries are way too long. So I switched it up.
Like physically long, like too many hours?
Oh my gosh. Like, they're so long.
Yeah.
The surgeries are like 6 to 12 hours long. Some of them, they have the tag team. So one team starts and the other team finishes. So they're really long surgeries. Mm-hmm. The brain is interesting to understand, but it's not interesting to look at because you're drilling a hole in a tiny, like a tiny hole in a skull. So you're looking in a very small space and it's just a long surgery and it's not very interesting.
That makes sense. So you were like, I'm going to do brain stuff without having to open up heads.
That's right. Well, I still like the OR, so I started off as an anesthesiologist after medical school. I did that for 2 years, anesthesiology residency. I didn't really like being by myself. It's a very, I think, lonely field. It's necessary because anesthesiologists keep you alive, but it's very isolating. It's lonely. Did that for 2 years, and I was like, I want to like learn about the brain again, and I miss talking to patients. And a friend of mine was a psychiatrist at Cornell, and she said, you should look into psychiatry because you love neuroscience and it's interesting. Mm-hmm. And I luckily got a spot at Columbia.
So looking back, it's like, oh, this all makes sense. She went to medical school and did all these things. And just becoming an anesthesiologist alone is an accomplishment. I immediately think of the loans and the price and all this. How did you afford to go to school and get all these degrees?
So when I was like in high school, I applied for every scholarship that you could think of. Like there was one in particular that I remember. It was for an Italian American football player, like who was like, I think like the oldest in his family. And I was like, well, I'm going to try if no other person applies. And I got the scholarship. So I was,
no way. So that is so funny. Those are the scholarships people need to apply to. The ones that are like boring or they think like everyone's going to apply to. It's like, no, you'd be surprised. Nobody applies to those.
No one does. And I got it. So I went, I remember the ceremony. I went to the lodge. It was a lodge. And I went to the lodge and there are all these like men there. They're like, who is this? But you know, they wanted to give the money to someone who was going to use it and no one else had applied. So they were like happy that I remember eating my Italian salad and chatting it up with the people and like, you know,
who's this girl? Right. You're just like, just
somebody
give me the money.
That asked if I was Italian. I was like, no.
Okay. Going back to like maybe your teenage years, what was your first job ever?
Oh, so I was a babysitter because in the church I had to watch a lot of the people in the church were lower income and they really couldn't afford childcare, but they had to work. So myself and my sisters, we babysat a lot and I loved it. I mean, the kids were so cute and I learned how to nurture. So that was my first job. And then at Wendy's, I was like the fry girl.
No, you were
I love Wendy's.
Oh my gosh, I want a Wendy's Frosty so bad right now. That'd be so good. Next time I'll get some Wendy's Frosties. And when you were younger, what did you want to be when you grew up?
I always knew I wanted to be a scientist.
Okay.
But then, you know, being in a lab is, it's great, but you're not necessarily working with people. Mm-hmm. So medicine kind of puts the science and working with people together.
And then last question, what is your current job?
That's a loaded question too. So I currently have like three businesses. My lab where I do a lot of clinical studies and I have a team and we help drugs go to market. So we work with pharma companies to develop new treatments for things from ADHD to postpartum depression to Alzheimer's dementia. So that part is really interesting. And then I have a private practice where I see patients in therapy and for medication management. And some of the children are as young as 4 and some of the adults are as old as in their 80s. So it's like a, you know, kind of like a family practice for psychiatry. And then the third business is the media business. It's one that I've had for a while because I consult with television and it started when I was teaching at NYU. The film students there have a real interest in portraying mental health issues accurately and responsibly. So I started off teaching those students and then that led to consulting for media, for television shows, for film. And that just took off.
Okay, I'm exhausted listening. I don't know how you balance your weeks because you run two companies, at least, well, three companies, really. So you also are a business owner and you have to hire and do like taxes and all of that. So how do you outsource?
A lot of help. And I went to business school. So halfway through medical school.
Yeah, let's go back to that. You got a casual MBA. Whatever.
Well, halfway through medical school, I realized I don't have any life skills. Like I can save someone's life, but I have no personal life skills, right? So I went to my dean and I was like, why don't we learn life skills? And she was like, well, you know, you could take a year off and do it. And I was like, I'm going to go to business school. So I learned a lot of my life skills from the business school students who are still my friends today, many of them were out doing accounting. Mm-hmm. They were in like finance or running businesses, and they decided to go back to business school. So I learned from them. Mm. And I think that people think they go to business school to learn in class. No, you learn from your peers. Mm. And that's where I learned how to, you know, make strategic decisions, leadership decisions, how to run a business so that it survives, because it's hard to run a business.
So you're in medical school, and you just take a break to go get your MBA?
So you can do a dual degree.
Oh, okay.
So what they do is they combine it. So like you're doing some of your rotations in the hospital. Okay. Usually you're done with your like basic classes. And then during the third year of medical school, you do rotations, like a month in surgery, a month in OBGYN, a month in derm, and so forth. But what they'll do is they'll let you do like some of them and then do your semesters in business school and then come back. And so you're going back and forth, and it works out.
So let's move on to your job, which is you running three businesses and being a professional psychiatrist. You own your own practice research lab, and you have your social media brand and company, and you market your professional brand online. How do you balance your days and take care of your own mental health when you are so ambitious?
I think the secret is not doing it all. So when I first started my company, it was like my baby. This is before I actually had a kid. It was like...
You have a kid too.
I do. I have a 7-year-old. but yeah, I think it's like letting go a bit, because at the beginning when I was building my business, it was like all I could think about. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to do everything. And that's like the worst way to manage a business. Mm-hmm. Like you need help. You need to hire people.
Absolutely.
And so I learned early on that I have to ask for help. I can't do everything. And I delegate. And like at the beginning, it's very uncomfortable because you're like, oh, what if it messes up? Nothing goes wrong. Things happen, and they work out better than if you did it. And then you get to rest and you get to actually have a life.
Absolutely. I always say hire really talented people and get out of their way.
And you actually save money. It may seem expensive, but getting a good lawyer, everyone should have a good lawyer.
Have a good lawyer, no matter what industry you're in.
Right. Never sign a contract without someone looking at it or writing the template for you. Like,
absolutely.
Ever.
Yeah. Okay. So it sounds like you're good at hiring like people.
Well, and that's the other thing.
Yeah.
So in my practice, I don't make the hiring decisions. I let other people hire.
But you hire the people who make the hiring
Correct.
Decisions.
Correct. Yes.
So you got it right the first time, and then you can just let them do the rest.
Because I find that when people come to see me, they're on their best behavior. I'm going to get the best part of them. I want to see what people are like in the team setting. And honestly, like my team, they're the ones that are going to be around the person the majority of the time.
That's so smart.
So they should be doing the hiring.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Like, if I was going to add another member to my team, like consulting everybody else and having them almost make the decision would be smarter. I love that.
Because they're going to try to impress you, and they're going to be perfect around you. So when there are problems, you're going to be like, but I never saw the problem.
Yeah.
And your team is like, well, that's
good.
We
saw it. Oh, that's a great piece of business advice. Wow, I love that. For anyone out there who's maybe looking to become a psychiatrist, what would you say are the honest pros and cons of your job?
So I do think that there's a mental health crisis, and there are just not enough people to meet that need. Mm-hmm. And there are other things you can do besides becoming a psychiatrist. Not to say that I'm discouraging people, but it's a long road.
Yeah.
Because it's 4 years of undergrad, 4 years of medical school, 4 years of residency. And then if you want to do a specialty like I did, like treating children, another 2 years. So that's a long time.
Yeah.
So you better be sure that you want to do it.
Wait, so you were in school for how many years total?
So a long time. So I did 4 years of undergrad. That's 4 plus 5 because I did the dual MD MBA. And that's 9 plus I did 2 years of anesthesia residency, 11 plus the 3 years of adult psychiatry. So it's 14 already. And then 2 years of fellowship. That's 16. That was a lot.
That's a lot of school.
My brain is worth a lot of money.
It is. We must get some insurance on your brain.
Right. It's a good thing I apply for all the scholarships.
Oh my gosh, seriously. You say there's a mental health crisis.
Yes.
And there is. I'm curious, do you think the pandemic is what caused this current mental health crisis?
I think it definitely contributed to it. I think before the pandemic, we were already not so great. But I liken it to when you're in the ocean and you're getting hit by a wave, and then, okay, another wave doesn't come by so you can recover. But then it was like, okay, the pandemic. Then it was like police brutality. Then it was like the uprising in Congress. And then it was like another wave of the pandemic. And then all these wars. And then all these things happening. It's just like we can't get a break.
Yeah, we can't get a break.
And then you have people from younger generations who can't find work, or they just feel as if, you know, the world's ending anyway because of pollution. It's just like one thing on top of the other. So I just, and then social media, because we're all on the social media throughout the pandemic to cope.
Absolutely.
So that, who knows what that's done to our brain in the long term. So there's just so much that we haven't had a chance to recover. And I think we're starting to see this really big crisis that's going to take a very long time to get out of.
Absolutely. So. It's interesting, you know, we're definitely in a mental health crisis right now. And at the same time, I think back to like, you know, the 1700s or like the Middle Ages. And I'm like, life was so hard. It seems like humans have never really been able to absolutely catch a break. Like in some ways, we're living in the best time in human history. And in other ways, it just looks so bleak some days.
So I think the difference between now and back in the what seems like the Dark Ages is that they had like ignorance is bliss. I know it sounds terrible, but like, they didn't know what was going on halfway across the globe, right?
Yeah.
They were just involved in what they knew.
Yeah.
And sometimes the knowing too much is not a good thing.
You go to like other countries where they don't have really a lot of access through their smartphones. I mean, it's growing more and more now. And everybody's like, oh, they seem so happy. And I'm like, well, first of all, they have the same complex emotions that all of us have. But second of all, they aren't able to see billionaires in their yachts every single day like we are. You typically follow people on social media who are wealthier and happier than you, or they appear that way. So yeah, I'm curious, but can you elaborate more on that?
I think their pain is contained, right? Like it's like you only know that you don't have something if you know that, if you don't think it exists, or if you don't know that it exists. So like I think I was recently in Barbados for vacation, and there was a man who refuses to sell his lot of land, and it's right next to these billionaires. And he's just like,
I love
like,
this guy.
I mean, they're offering him like $8 million for this land.
I love that.
And I think he's like right next to Simon Cowell's like $100 million mansion. But he's just like waving at us, and he's like living in like a shack, right? And he's happy. He's just like, why would I sell this? Because what's going to happen? I'm going to go and buy a place in another part of Barbados, and maybe I won't have a view of the water, and maybe I'll see that my neighbor is this and that. And like, you know, I have a whole set of other problems. At least I know what my problems are here, and I like my view.
That reminds me of that story of the fisherman. Have you ever heard that, where the businessman comes up to the fisherman and he's like, you know, you got this boat. Like, why don't you hire somebody? And I'll teach you how to fish. And the fisherman's like, well, and then what? And he's like, well, then you can buy another boat and you can start your own company. And he's like, then what? And then you can buy a bigger boat and hire more people. And he's like, and then what? And he's like, well, then you can retire. And he's like, and then fish all day? He's like, that's what I'm doing right now. He's like, why would I go through all that work just to get back to the point of happiness where I'm at right now? Mm-hmm. So taking that a step further, do you think that like social media is a bad idea and we should just all delete our Instagram accounts?
I don't think so. I think social media is here to stay. I do think that everything, it has positives and negatives. Mm-hmm. For example, I like treated someone years ago who had no access to anyone who was queer. At all. And like social media was the first place that they were able to see
absolutely
that, oh my gosh, I'm not the only one. And there's like people are happy and they're living their best lives and they're being them. This is possible, right?
Yep.
Without social media, they had no idea that that was even possible.
Totally.
So, and the same with religious beliefs. There are people who are in communities where they're the only underrepresented person within their religious minority, whatever it is. And they see that, you know, there's hope.
Yeah.
So I do think that social media provides that community for people who don't have access,
mm-hmm.
and it provides information.
Yeah.
But there's a huge source of misinformation,
mm-hmm.
and also it can be used, you know, to bully and harass and to divide. So I think like everything, we have to A, understand it and educate ourselves. I have this like RESET acronym for it, like realize how it impacts you, educate yourself about the positives and negatives, have a strategy for how to contain it because you shouldn't be on it all the time, and then, you know, have realistic expectations from it, and then be thoughtful about it. So like really be very mindful about the way that you use social media, just like you would with food, just like you would with alcohol.
Diet, media diet,
right, everything that you consume, because you are consuming it, should be thoughtful and measured, and there should be a strategy.
Yeah, I was wondering about what you think, because you are a very qualified medical professional giving advice, and you do it in such an engaging way. I wonder what your thoughts are on people, you know, kind of making those videos, three signs they're narcissists, kind of taking this like complex stuff and boiling it down, and then having young people see that and then diagnosing their parents and their friends as, you know, narcissists or whatever. What are kind of your thoughts on that?
I can empathize, because when I started learning in psychiatry and in training, it was hard for me to be like, oh my God, I think this is what this person has. And like, so when I see followers doing that, I'm like, well, that's like an early therapist, right? Mm-hmm. Or an early student. And they're like, they have to learn how to separate and how to not assume, because you can't, you just can't diagnose someone like that. Yeah. You have to have like a, that type of like treatment relationship where the person is there to, you know, better themselves or to get help. And so you can't just go around diagnosing people. But I can empathize with people who look at these things and they're like, oh my gosh, I think this is happening. Mm-hmm. I do think some content is better than others at, you know, being really responsible and saying, okay, these are things that may happen, right? Mm-hmm. Like, not, this is definitely, you know, what's happening.
Yeah.
So I think you have to be responsible. But people will look at it. And you have to be like aware that like people all have different education and experience. So you could have someone who's more nuanced looking at something and saying, oh, that's it could be this and that. And you could have someone who isn't as nuanced being like, oh my gosh, this is it.
Yeah.
So you have to be responsible when you make this content so that you're not leading people into the wrong direction and having them assume that this is like 100% truth.
Definitely. I was going to ask you about that. So like talking about the pros and cons of social media, and like your content has absolutely educated people about topics, you know, high functioning depression, all these things that they had never had exposure to before, especially people who maybe live in families where mental health is very stigmatized. I'm wondering where you think the line is though, between like the positive of education and the cons of like self-diagnosing. And people watching your content and being like, oh, I'm depressed. Oh, I'm anxious, when really they're just maybe feeling sad or they're feeling anxious, and then not seeking help because, you know, they think that maybe they can just get it through social media.
Yeah, I think that's why long form is important. So what I was finding was that people would look at my content and then reach out to me and say, I think I have this. What should I do? Mm-hmm. And often I would respond and say, you know, like, this is just for education only, but people get dissatisfied with that. They want answers, and there aren't a lot of people out there to provide therapy. There's a shortage. Yeah. So I think that by providing, like, I have a podcast where I talk with experts.
Love your podcast.
And I have, thank you. and I recommend other podcasts. So like people can learn more. The first step is realization, but then they want something that's like skills based, and they want to do something about it. So I encourage people to read books. Sometimes I'll put like a book up. I'll have like a reel where I'm like, these are helpful books for anxiety. These are helpful books for depression, whatever. But I think that they need to dig a little deeper. They can't just use like 60 seconds and say, okay, I'm healed, or I understand this.
Yeah.
And sometimes I'll literally say that in my caption, like, you're not doing yourself a good service if you don't, you know, read more or learn more, because this is just one, you know, reel.
Any tips for anybody when they're looking for a therapist? Because I know, like, you can't just have somebody who makes you feel good about yourself all the time. You need to have somebody who challenges you. So any tips?
I think that first, make sure that they have their credentials. There's a website called Psychology Today.
Okay.
And they verify people. Mm. So someone can call themselves Dr. So-and-so, but if Psychology Today doesn't have your credentials, they will not allow you to call yourself a doctor.
Okay.
Right? And then, you know, there's differences. So there's people who are licensed clinical social workers. Mm-hmm. So they do therapy. Mm-hmm. And they typically have a master's degree.
Okay.
And then there's PhDs who have a doctorate degree. So you're going to have a harder time finding a PhD than you would a licensed clinical therapist. So if you're looking for someone to do a specific type of therapy, let's say you have trauma, and you want to ask that person, how familiar are you with trauma work?
So now we're going to move to this section where I like to ask just some like fun questions. So the first question I have is, what is a piece of advice that you're happy you ignored?
Oh, so when I was starting my own lab, I went to a very respected mentor and I said, you know, I want to do this. I want to start my own lab. And they were like, well, you should work with someone older. Mm. I mean, I think that was code for
you shouldn't do it by yourself because you're just a girl.
You're just a little girl. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, oh. But I've never shied away from risks. And so, you know, coming from a Caribbean background,
yeah,
where I was an immigrant, yeah, and you're supposed to do like become a doctor, lawyer, accountant, and don't make any risks. Like, mm-hmm, having a business is risky.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I did it. Leaving anesthesiology was risky. My parents were not about that. They were like, why would you leave being a real doctor to be a doctor for crazy people?
Oh, so was there stigma in your family growing up?
Oh, yes, for sure. Like in church, it's spirits are the reason that people have mental health issues. That's
demons.
Yeah, the demons. And I tell you, my church has come a long way since then. And so is my father. Like now he talks about mental health issues.
It's not necessarily spiritual. Oh, I love that journey for him.
Right. And I always tell him, I said, Daddy, you're like the first therapist in the family because people go to you. They, you know, pastors counsel people all the time.
The amount of people who go to church and they should probably also be going to therapy. But, you know, I say whatever works.
Yeah.
But I feel like I did grow up with some people where I'm like, you probably need to see a medical doctor about what's going on.
Absolutely. A lot of churches now are incorporating it. They're training people in like mental health CPR.
Next question. Well, first of all, I want to go back to that. So they told you, piece of advice that you're happy you ignored is somebody telling you that you should partner with somebody more established when you're opening up your own practice. You ignored that advice. Mm-hmm. Worked out for you.
It did. Yeah. I mean, it's scary. Like starting your own business is scary.
Yeah.
And I started two at the same time because everything I do has to be synergistic. So like, the mental health research has to somehow help me in the therapy, and then the media stuff help, like, it all goes together or else it's just not gonna work. I'm not gonna start like a cupcake business and then or else it'll be too different.
Yeah.
So it had to make sense.
Yeah.
Or else it would drive me literally crazy.
That's really cool. So your research informs your psychiatry practice. Oh, that's fascinating. Okay, next question. What's the hardest thing you've ever done, personally or professionally?
Well, I think being a business owner is very difficult. It is a full-time 24/7 job.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you do it, it's rewarding because you don't have to answer to anyone.
Yeah.
So the freedom is like amazing.
Yeah.
But then you have to learn how to turn it off.
Yeah.
Because like it will literally, you know, take over your entire being if you let it.
Yeah.
So that was difficult, but it's rewarding.
Mm.
I liken it to, you know, giving birth. Like it's like, that's your baby.
What's something that you've recently changed your mind on?
So this whole idea of like neurodiversity is something that I have had to actively learn.
Okay.
Like on the fly.
Yeah.
Right. So like in my child psychiatry training, we learned about autism with an M, right?
Yeah.
In some circles, if you use that word, it's like, it's not a condition. So you have to really listen to people. And it's like the first person language, how they identify.
Mm.
So I've really had to like retrain myself in that sense, because when we're in training, we learn about autism and behaviors and so forth, but it's not, it's taken from a lens of like, okay, this is typical and this is atypical and this is healthy and this is unhealthy. But I think that what we're learning now is that some people are more on the end of a spectrum where they're nonverbal or they have really, a lot of discomfort with sensory stimulation and they really need a lot of support.
Yeah.
And other people are on the other end of the spectrum where they may still have some of these sensory things, but they are verbal. They're, you know, you would never know.
It's
right?
Like more subtle. Yeah.
It's more subtle. And not to say they don't need support, but they don't need as much support or different types of support. So learning about autistic individuals this way has been so interesting.
Yeah.
And I think we, as providers, we have to learn from them rather than talking at them because we really need to relearn autistic people and autistic behaviors.
Yeah. It's tough when it's a spectrum disorder, or I guess, I don't know. Are you guys even still calling it a disorder? Or I know it's the DSM.
Still, it's still in the DSM because, you know, without these classifications, people don't get support. So if someone is nonverbal and they need help with developing speech, well, you got to code it or else you can't bill insurance and they can't get the supports.
Absolutely.
And they need supports in school, you know? So like you really it's unfortunate the word disorder is used.
Yeah.
But it's what's used in the billing, and it's what we have to use to get people support.
Got it. Yeah, it's interesting when it's a spectrum, because it's like, if you have a broken arm, you have a broken arm. But when it's a spectrum, it's like, okay, yeah, you said these people will need way more support than these folks.
But I think that, I think that's the way that mental health conditions are going to be approached in the future, because there are people who have severe schizophrenia where they're constantly hallucinating or they're delusional. But then you have people who have some mild paranoia and may have hallucinations, but they're not as intrusive, and they're still, like, you know, running companies and still being doctors. I know one of my attendings in medical school had schizophrenia and was very open about it.
Really?
And they were doing their job every day. So I think that we have to see all these different faces of conditions. We can't just have, like, okay, this is the idea of what it looks like, because then we're not being inclusive. Yeah. The same for depression. That's why I study high functioning depression, because people think depression is someone crying and they think you're sad or you're not getting out of bed. But there are people who are walking around getting things done, don't identify with the word depression, but they have anhedonia, which is like the
Tell us, educate us. What is anhedonia?
So anhedonia is a medical term that's been around since the 1800s, and it's been in the literature and research. And for some reason, it never made it quite outside of medicine. So, like, most people don't know what it is.
Okay.
I spoke to a journalist today, and she called it. She was like, so tell me about anhedonia.
Like, no, no. Ammonia. Tell us about it.
It's anhedonia. An means no, like, or lack of. Hid is pleasure, like hedonism. And then, you know, yeah, at the end. So
it's the Latin root.
Right.
Break it down for us. So anhedonia, is that in the DSM?
So it is, actually. It's under, it's not its own diagnosis, but it's a symptom.
Okay.
So it's a symptom of possibly schizophrenia, depression, substance abuse.
Okay. So it's not its own diagnosis, but it's rather a symptom.
It's
okay.
A symptom, yeah. And so it really means that lack of pleasure, lack of interest, lack of joy, that the blah, like,
Yeah.
You know? And so I think a lot of people are walking around with anhedonia, and they don't know what it is. So they just think that something's wrong with them. And why am I not happy? You know, well, are you depressed? No. Do you feel blah or meh? Yeah. Well, that's anhedonia.
Yeah.
And anhedonia is a symptom of depression. And you don't have to have depressed or sad mood to meet criteria for depression. I don't think people know that. It's actually in the DSM. Like, you can have either anhedonia or depressed mood, one or the other.
Wow.
But high-functioning depression is different. It's not major depressive disorder. It's not even a condition that's recognized, but I'm seeing it in my practice.
Oh, and so this is something that are you trying to, like, get this in the DSM?
Well, I'm trying to get language and more dialogue around it.
Okay.
I think that's a whole process to get it in the DSM.
I believe in you.
But I am studying it in my lab, and, like, you would never question imposter syndrome, right? You never say, like, it doesn't exist. It's not in the DSM, but a lot of people walk around with it.
Oh, interesting. You
know? Something like burnout is not in the DSM. It's in the WHO.
WHO, yeah.
But
interesting.
You know, but you would never say, oh, that doesn't exist, because it's not in the DSM.
Yeah.
I mean, the DSM's only been around for how long? Like, less than, who knows? It wasn't even around in the 1800s. And anhedonia was. So
Wow.
I think high-functioning depression, what I see it as, is like a prodrome, like the leading up to either a burnout or a major depressive disorder or a substance use disorder or a behavioral addiction. But it's like the leading up, where you don't quite meet criteria for depression, because you're still functioning, you're still getting things done. You may even be exceeding your functioning, but you have all of these symptoms of depression and something just doesn't feel right. And my theory is that if we can identify it and we can address it, then you don't get all the things that happen. Why wait? In medicine, we're always waiting for something to go wrong, to stop working.
Let's be proactive.
Let's just fix it now. Because if we can identify it, if you're walking around feeling meh or blah, then these are things that you could potentially do to prevent yourself from getting to a point where you actually have a major depressive disorder.
Do you think that this is something that's a result of, like, the dopamine from social media, lack of community, the pandemic? Like, what do you think is causing this?
I think all of the above. I think I look at it as, like, the biopsychosocial model.
Biopsychosocial. Say that three times fast.
every symptom or disease has a biopsychosocial model in medicine.
Okay.
So the bio is, like, the biology, what makes us. So I think that biologically, you know, something like over 70% of us got COVID. Who knows how long mm-hmm. that's going to impact our mm-hmm. brains. I think biologically, you know, we're in an age where there's so much processed food yeah. and we're getting exposed to all these inflammatory things. There's mm-hmm. pollution. Some of us biologically are more prone to certain conditions because of genetics.
Absolutely, yeah.
Psychologically, there's a lot of trauma. So like I mentioned, all of the things that went wrong or could go wrong went wrong for us. You know, you had the pandemic and all these police brutality and wars and just, it's like bad news after the, like yes. all these traumas.
Yes.
And then people have personal traumas, right? Yeah. And then from the social aspects, people are numbing their pain by being online.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have a choice. During the pandemic, we were online, but that became excessive. And we're seeing children using social media or being on screens for hours at a time. And their brains are just not supposed to be there.
Yeah.
Adults' brains are not supposed to be there. We're not built for Zooms.
We're not built for that.
We're not supposed to be looking at our faces all the time. That's unhealthy for us. We're not supposed to be staring at a screen. We're supposed to be moving and talking and being in a real world.
Touching grass.
Right. Or at least just like not like on a screen.
Yeah.
And I think also like socially, there's just a lot happening in society. You know, corporations just get richer and richer, and they squeeze the little guy, and they've learned that if they keep pushing, they'll make money, and we'll and the rest of us are just trying to get up there. And like, it's just there's just so much going on. So I think that a lot of things contribute to anhedonia.
Yeah.
And if you think about the 2020, for me, sometimes I'm like looking at my phone, and I'm like, wait, that happened? So it was like a blur.
Oh,
and the forgetfulness is a trauma response. So like if you find yourself not remembering large pieces of time, that could be trauma. So I do think that the numbing is a trauma response, but it's also all the things that are happening that are contributing to this state of blah and meh.
It's interesting. I mean, was last year 2019? It feels like it to me. Like, it's so weird. But I feel like this collective trauma that literally the entire world experienced, it almost makes it worse because we look around and everyone else is doing fine. So it's like, it almost makes us repress it even more because it's like, well, everybody else went through it too. And it's just how the world is. I'm curious with anhedonia, if anybody's listening and they're like, wait, that's piquing my interest. Like, what's a scenario? Can you, like, describe a person who would be experiencing this versus a person who's maybe just, like, having a bad day?
Well, I mean, I developed an anhedonia rating scale that people can fill out on my website.
Ooh, okay. And cool. We'll put that up here somewhere.
And it really looks at, like, a lot of the points in a day where we can feel joy. And, like, joy may not be the best word because it implies happiness is the outcome that you want.
Oh, okay.
I think that, you know, having a more textured view of what joy is. So some of the things on there are like, you know, do you savor meals? So like when you eat, it's not necessarily joy. It's like feeling satisfied, feeling nourished. So using more textured words to describe the human experience and actually experiencing them. So like, instead of like looking at someone cooking on your phone and then they're eating it, put the phone away and actually look at your food and like describe what you're eating. So these very small things that you do, like with this tea, I'm going to drink that tea. I'm going to think about the chamomile and, you know, like whatever it tastes like, what it smells like, really be present in the moment. And I find that this works because my theory is that a lot of this is related to trauma and unprocessed trauma. So like these are grounding techniques that get you back into your body, get you back into your senses, and then you start to feel again. And I think that's important for combating anhedonia, which is like the lack of feeling.
Yeah.
So you want to start feeling every little moment again, as much as possible.
Yeah, it's interesting. I try to, you know, practice gratitude, which has become such like a thing I feel like people kind of roll their eyes at, but it's so true. If you wake up every morning and you name three things that like it should make like a warm feeling in your chest, you know, it should like make you so grateful. That just having that warm feeling in the morning like sets up the rest of your day, or at least for me, with like good vibes. But yeah, I feel like we, with the hustle and bustle, with social media, with picking up our phones whatever 5,000 times a day or whatever we do, it doesn't allow space for us to feel, to savor. I love that word, savor. That's amazing. So anhedonia is something that you're really interested in researching right now. Why do you think it's such a threat and a big issue and something people should be talking more about?
I think it's contagious. I think that, and I look at myself at my like peak anhedonia moments when everyone was like, oh my gosh, she's like got this lab, she's doing this and that. But I was just like on the go, like do this, do that. And it was like a numbing mechanism for stress. But when you look around, like at least for myself, when I looked around at my team, they didn't seem very happy. They seemed stressed too. So I think it's contagious. So I had to actually work on my own anhedonia and be like, wait, what am I doing? I got to cut back on these studies. I got to cut back on these projects. Let me focus on things that I really want to learn and enjoy. And then everyone else is looking like, oh, like she's relaxed. We can relax too. So I do think that anhedonia is contagious, but I also think that when you change your life to have more joyful moments, that's also contagious because people will come up to you and say, what are you doing differently? Like, do you get like new hairstyle? It's like, no, it's like less stress.
Oh my gosh. Absolutely. I say you should prioritize joy every day. Like literally prioritize joy the same way that you prioritize going to the gym and eating healthy meals. You should prioritize laughing every day, talking to somebody who makes you feel good about yourself, like invoking those good feelings, because we think looking at social media is fun, but it is just like destroying us. You need to like actually have real interactions. So I want to hear more about high functioning depression. Can you tell, you know, the viewers like what the heck that is?
Well, so major depressive disorder has these symptoms that you have to meet criteria for, and then they have to cause a lowered functioning or an impact in functioning or significant distress. Okay. But if you have like a lot of these symptoms and you're not having significant distress or problems with functioning and you're actually exceeding in functioning, you may not feel like things are right, but a doctor is not going to say, well, let's get you into therapy. Let's do something about this. Because why? Because the way the medical system is set up, you didn't meet criteria for not functioning. So I'll see you in a year. Good luck to you.
Is that because this is the only thing I remember from my psychology classes. The DSM would, I just remember it saying like, you basically only officially have a disorder if it's impacting your life. Is that kind of how it operates?
Impacts functioning, yes.
Impacts functioning. So you're saying,
or causes significant distress for depression.
Yeah. So you're saying high functioning depression won't technically meet that threshold?
No, because these people are like, they're doing well and they're not all CEOs. Some of them are like, you know, the single mom who's taking care of four kids and making sure they're on time.
Surviving.
That's like, that's a hard job, you know? So like, you know, I think that people just push through negative emotions and they don't feel. So that's why they don't acknowledge that distress. That's a criteria. And if you're functioning and meeting all of your goals, right, then see you later. Come back when things are broken, right? And I think that that's not a great model. And we miss out on a whole bunch of people who could have a better life and then prevent things from happening. So if people don't know what anhedonia is, which is one of the key symptoms, then they're not going to know that something's wrong. They're going to be like, well, everyone feels that way. I do think that in our society, we don't really process trauma. I think that's a new thing. Younger generations talk about it. But I think that, you know, traditionally, you're supposed to just, everyone has a problem. Everyone has issues. Just
suck it
get
up.
Through it. Yeah, suck it up. But hopefully that's changing. But I think that's why people don't acknowledge what's happening, because it's just not a part of the dialogue. And look at, we don't have a COVID-19 memorial. You know, some places are talking about doing it, but there's something so powerful about having these memorials that say, this bad thing happened. It wasn't your fault. It happened to all of us. Let's acknowledge it. Let's put aside time and a day for it so we remember it. And then we remember that some of us were lost. I think there's power in that recognition, but we all feel it. We all feel like it's not the same, but no one's saying it. You know, it's not like being really acknowledged. It's like, well, just get through it. You lived through it.
It's the elephant in the room. Yeah. I'm always kind of going back and forth between like yes, we need to expand, you know, to give people more resources and help them understand themselves better. And at the same time, not like over-labeling people.
Yeah.
At what point do you think that diagnosing people liberates and validates them versus labeling and limiting them?
I think that labels are really important. There's something called affect labeling, and there is something therapeutic about knowing what something is. It releases anxiety. So it's like if you are walking down an alleyway and it's dark and you hear something, you're going to imagine the worst. But if someone puts their car lights on and you see it's a cat, you're like, oh, phew, I'm safe, right?
Yeah.
So like knowing what it is so powerful. And that's one of the interventions, the basic interventions I do in my therapy, like going through the DSM and saying, oh, you have borderline personality disorder. Let's look at this. You have fear of abandonment. You have rageful mood swings. Sometimes, you know, you're rejection sensitive and all these things. And it's like, wow, I have all those things. Oh my gosh, that's what it is.
It's like a light bulb goes off. Yeah.
It's also important because sometimes people get misdiagnosed. So like with borderline personality disorder, people come in and they've been put on medicine for bipolar disorder and they don't have bipolar disorder. There are no FDA approved medications for borderline personality disorder. So if you get a misdiagnosis, if you get the wrong label, you're not going to get the right medication. And you should, some people don't even need medications, right? You're not going to get the right therapy or the intervention. So I think that it's powerful to label because you identify the issue and that releases you, that relieves you of the anxiety and you get the right treatment. There is something where people are getting, I guess, misdiagnosed and too many labels, like the word narcissism is used a lot. And some people are not narcissistic. Some people have, you know, avoidant attachment and they have had a lot of hurt in their early lives and they don't want to commit to someone. Just because someone doesn't want to commit to you doesn't mean that they're a narcissist.
Yeah.
But narcissist is one of those words that gets like slapped across everything. That's, oh, you're a jerk. You're a narcissist.
You know, like. I feel like in the past few years, it's been, probably in part due to social media, or maybe we just have more narcissists popping up all over the place. Who knows? I'm curious about attachment styles. I went down a rabbit hole about attachment styles with my friend who works in early childhood development. And I'm wondering if you could just explain for the audience, like, what the attachment styles are.
So that's another thing that's not in the DSM, but it's well studied, right? So we don't go around diagnosing someone, but we say that they have a style, right? That's the same with narcissistic personality styles, not necessarily narcissistic personality disorder. So, but, you know, when we are raised, the first person that we look to trust and to feel safe with is the person who's raising us. Typically, it's a parent or it could be another guardian. And if that parent is consistent, and not overbearing and who's nurturing and supportive and has healthy ways of communicating with you and you feel that they're reliable, then you're going to develop a secure attachment to them. So what they were looking at with these children, these babies, was that a secure baby, when their mother would leave the room or the parent would leave the room, they would cry, they would fuss, but it was appropriate.
It's appropriate.
And when the parent came back, they would be soothed and they'd be happy. And it's like nothing happened.
They go back
like,
to playing.
Right. I knew my mama would come back because she loves me and I'm cute, you know? But like the anxious child would be hysterical when the mother left, when the parent left. And just, and there's just like, it was like overboard. So like you see that deep fear of abandonment. And then when the mother came back or the parent came back, they couldn't be consoled.
Just keep crying.
They kept crying. They kept, because they, even if the mother is there, they are like, well, what if you leave again? And so you see these adults.
Like clinging on.
Who are very, very clingy. Who sometimes don't trust because they're constantly worrying about someone leaving them. And then you have the avoidance. So this is a child that knows that their parent is not reliable. So it's like, what's the point of trusting anyone? You got to depend on yourself. So if a parent left the room, there was very little reaction. And in fact, if there was a stranger in the room, they would attach fine. It's like, oh, you're just another adult.
That's so sad.
It's very sad. And when the parent returned, it was like, well, you're back, you know?
What are they like when they grow up avoidant?
So they, again, they believe that, you know, you can't depend on anyone. You got to just depend on yourself. And they have a hard time sharing. They have a hard time being vulnerable, opening up, partnering, a lot of intimacy issues. And then you have people who have a mixture of the anxious and the avoidant. So yeah. So luckily half of the population is secure. Like 20 are like anxious, avoidant, and the rest are like a mixture of the two. But if you have anxious attachment, again, you may have that avoid, that fear of abandonment. And if you're avoidant, you feel as if, you know, you're on your own in this life and you're good. But everyone needs to attach, or else we'd all be walking around alone, right? We all want to that human interaction. We all need it. And people who lack human interaction actually die sooner. So like our relationships really do matter. It's not like in the 90s where you would read these books that are like, you know, the woman on the top of the mountain, like, yeah, I did it. I'm by myself and I don't need a man.
Independent woman.
Right. I tell my patients when they're having a hard time with breakup, it's like, no, like you were in a relationship. You depend on this person. There's nothing weak about you. You're supposed to attach. We're made to attach.
Oh, I love that for breakup advice.
Oh, yeah.
It's like it's a healthy thing that you're grieving the relationship.
I'd be concerned if you weren't, you know. So don't beat yourself up for that. Feel the feels. And the next time around, understand what your attachment style is. Know what the red flags are when you're dating so that you can tell if someone's secure, anxious, or avoidant.
And I'm sure there's different things for different people, but how, you know, if somebody just listened to you and they're like, oh my gosh, I am definitely anxious, you know, I'm avoidant, how can they start that process of becoming secure?
I do think it requires a lot of help. Mm-hmm. And I think that because avoidant attachment is rooted in trauma, trauma work is helpful. So with a therapist, trusting someone with your deepest, darkest secrets, I mean, talk about, like, that's scary, right?
Yeah.
So if you have the capacity to do that with a therapist, then you have the capacity to do that with someone outside of therapy.
Yeah.
And therapy, I mean, you can pretty, most times you can be sure that person's not going to harm you.
Yeah.
And they won't leave you.
Yeah.
But I think if you start there, you're repairing that relationship. I liken therapy to a jumpstart in development.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I see patients in my office and I'm like, I can tell right when your development got halted, right?
Oh, you can tell.
Sometimes people are so like childlike and it's like, what was being 12 like for you? You know, like,
and then you can pinpoint the year and you go right back to that year.
Sometimes you can, like, wow. But you ask, you know?
Yeah.
And then, you know, others, you're like, were you ever a kid?
Yeah, you just grew up right away.
Right.
That's so interesting.
Your patients don't even know that because they walk around and they haven't processed their pain.
Wow.
And that therapy opens up this whole new realization for them and jumpstarts the development.
So you do a lot of work with depression. What is something that you wish more people understood about depression?
So I think depression has like different faces. And if you're looking for someone who's crying and sad and like doesn't make you feel good, then you're missing out on depression, because sometimes people are like the life of the party and they're magnetic and charismatic and they have depression,
mm-hmm.
especially with artists.
Mm.
So that I work with, they can't afford to never be on, because if they're sad and like glum, someone else is going to get the part.
Absolutely.
So they're constantly masking and they mask in the face of rejection, you know, like they go to auditions and they get turned down, but they can't show that. Mm-hmm. They have to be like upbeat. So there are some professions where you're constantly masking depression. Healthcare is one of those.
Mm.
If you look sad and you're a doctor, I mean, good luck with that.
Yeah,
you know?
Seriously. I know.
A nurse, there's so much bullying in healthcare. It's like you have to show up.
Mm.
You have to be there for the patient. You know, you got to basically lay your life on the line for all the patients. And it's like, not right. Like doctors and the healthcare workers have to take care of themselves, because
Absolutely.
Doctors make mistakes when they're unhappy.
Yeah.
When they're not well rested.
Yeah.
They make the wrong diagnosis.
Yeah.
So it's not just a matter of like caring for doctors and, and nurses' well-being. It's a matter of life and death for the patient.
Absolutely.
So I think there needs to be a rewiring in a lot of industries when it comes to depression. It's not what you think it is.
Yeah, that's so true. Yeah, check in on your happy friends, check in on your funny friends.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, you know, talking about getting overworked in healthcare, definition, I mean, so many people have left that industry in the past three, 4 years due to burnout. So I'm curious, I know burnout isn't an official diagnosis in the DSM. Do you think there's different types of burnout?
Oh, you mean like the slow burn?
I don't know. I just feel like everyone is like dealing with some level of burnout right now, but for some people it seems more dire than others.
I think so. Burnout by definition is like you're exhausted, you're no longer functioning.
Mm.
So, you know, I do a lot of work with high functioning depression where there's anhedonia.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the precursor to things like burnout and actual major depressive disorder is high functioning depression.
Yeah.
So I do think you can catch it before you're literally burnt.
Okay. Got it.
But, you know, burnout is something that like a vacation is not going to cure.
Yeah.
It usually has to do with the actual situation and the environment. And if the environment doesn't change, you're just going to go on vacation, rest, sleep, and then come back and get burned, you know?
Yeah. Again. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what are you seeing is most effective when you're helping patients with burnout? Like what's a recommendation that you're giving? And then it seems to have a very positive result.
So because burnout is by definition tied to your occupation,
mm-hmm.
I have that very real conversation with people. Like, is this job worth it?
Mm-hmm.
Because it will kill you, you know? And many people will say, well, yeah, my plan is like, I'm going to work. And then at 40, I'm going to retire and I have all this money. I was like, okay, if you survive, you know, but you know that, go in with your eyes wide open.
Yeah.
And other people are like, I cannot do another day at this job. Like, yeah. I literally can't. And they have to walk away. I try to work with my patients to mm-hmm. at least have like 3 months of savings and yeah. like a backup huge. Plan.
Yeah, that's huge for burnout. Simply right. saving money.
Because if you burn out and you don't have a job, then you're going to be depressed.
Makes it so much worse. Right. Yeah. And I was listening to a podcast you were on mm-hmm. and somebody recommended, I'm sorry, I don't remember her name.
Farnoosh.
Yes. She recommended just getting like a chiller job.
Yeah.
And I, genius recommendation. Right. Like just like become, I don't know, a part-time barista mm-hmm. in the meantime mm-hmm. while you cool off and figure out mm-hmm. what your next move is. You don't have to quit your job cold turkey and have nothing to do. A lot of people are dealing with burnout right now. I mean, I give career advice. It is all over my DMs every single day. People feeling very burnt out, or they're describing feeling burnt out to me. Do you think that more people are burnt out now than like they were in, say, the 90s or the 80s?
I think so, because I think there's a lot more working from home, and with technology, there's no break. Back in the 90s when I was like growing up and seeing my mom on those clunky computers, because my mother worked in the church as a pastor's wife, but she also was a secretary at AT&T. So like she was like on those clunky big computers. You can't get a lot of work done on those.
One finger at a time. Yeah.
I mean, they're just so slow.
Yeah.
But now our devices, we can put them in our pockets. So we have access to work whenever we want. And I think that's a bad thing. Mm-hmm. So we have to be mindful to limit it. There's no need for you to be checking your emails when you're not at work. So I think burnout happens because work is just literally anywhere you want it to be. You could be on a beach in Bali and you still have access to work. That Absolutely. Wasn't the case 30 years ago.
You could actually take a day off and no one could reach you. And now it's like, well, they can reach you, and they can reach you for just a tiny little thing mm-hmm. if they want to. So it's interesting, you know, there's a lot of talk about boundary setting on social media right now. And people are afraid that if they, you know, set those boundaries with their boss, that they're going to get fired. Or if they just do their job, that they're going to get fired. People are just always afraid of that scarcity of getting laid off, getting fired, no longer having a job. And at the same time, people are also setting, you know, stricter boundaries with employers. So it's like this careful balance of like, how do we advocate for ourselves at work, but not put ourselves on the chopping block? So I always say, literally the solution is just to be an incredible employee when you're at work. Mm-hmm. Like, be so good. Mm-hmm. The company literally can't afford to lose you. And that way, when you do take your vacation and you turn off your phone, they're not going to fire you for not responding to an email. So I'm wondering, what's your take on my theory?
I mean, that literally before you said it, that's what I'm.
Really?
I tell my team, if you're away and we're like, oh my gosh, we can't wait till she comes back.
Yeah.
You're doing a great job.
That's a good thing.
If you're away and it's like, man, she coming back?
Yeah. It's like, does she really have to come back?
Then that's not a great thing. Right. Yeah. So you shouldn't be the wrench in the machine. I forget what the saying is. Mm-hmm. You should be that oil that without it, we're like, oh man, we need that oil.
We need it.
Back,
yeah. Right?
So I 100% agree. You don't mm-hmm. have to worry. It's like the attachment style, right?
Mm.
The baby will not cry when mama comes back because mama is a good mama.
Yeah. Right? Like, she comes back.
So if you're doing a great job,
be a good mama. No, but it's true. I think a lot of people think that like the hours you put in, and at some toxic jobs, that is the case. The hours you put in equate to how good of an employee people think you are. But at the end of the day, any company just wants you to be a profitable employee. And so if you can go there and make the company profits, your job is safe.
Not just profitable, but pleasant. Like,
pleasant, yeah.
It's so hard to find people who are both profitable and pleasant.
Yes.
So if you're both, you're good.
You're good to
go. Set all the boundaries you want. If you're one of the other, work on the other too.
Yep. Oh, I'm so glad. Okay. This is now Dr. Judith approved my theory. Okay. Do you think that people are ever scared to get better because they don't know who they are without their illness?
So I do think there is something like that we see all the time. And so a lot of like inpatient hospitalizations, they want to be very brief because they don't want people to be there for long periods of time, because then you forget what it's like to be out in the world.
Oh.
So, you know, there is that component.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that sometimes people use excuses a lot, and, you know, explaining something is not the same as excusing it.
So I like, always say that. An explanation is not always an excuse.
No, it's not.
You can explain I have this mental illness, but it doesn't excuse you going around hurting people.
Right. Yeah. And so like, if you're not doing anything about it, if you're not addressing it, if you're just complaining, that's on you.
Mm-hmm. Do you at some points, you know, you'll be seeing somebody for a few years, not seeing a lot of progress and have to kind of gently tell them?
Oh, yeah, all the time. All the time. Yeah. Like, I wish that I could say that, like, every single patient is the same level of ease. But no, like, that would not make me a good doctor, right? I have, like, a range of patients that have challenges and others that other times don't have challenges, right? Mm-hmm. So I do think that at the end of the day, therapy is not, like, a key. I can't, like, look at you and fix you. Like, yeah. A lot of it has to do with yourself and, like, you're wanting to do the work.
You have to want to change.
You do. And yeah. Do the work, too.
And do the work. And it's not fun.
It's not.
Not always fun. Well, this has been excellent. So this last piece that we do here is that I have my viewers write in conundrums, things that they need advice on. So you can do that. I'll put the link somewhere here. And I just thought this was perfect for you. So I'll read the segment and then we can give our 2 cents on it. And you can pay us $5 billion. Just kidding. Dear Erin and Judith, I'm struggling with what I can only describe as chronic recurring work burnout. I've never found a job that I've genuinely enjoyed or found fulfilling. Work seems to drain all my energy and takes away from the activities I'm truly passionate about. I always start a new job with a positive attitude, but by the 6-month mark, I'm already feeling fried. I don't believe I'm dealing with depression as I maintain an active social life with friends, engage in various hobbies, and find enjoyment outside of work. I write, exercise regularly, game in moderation, and have a passion for music. The issue really lies in my relationship with work. The burnout is so severe that I start neglecting tasks and responsibilities. I'm slow to respond to messages and the lack of motivation to push for things that could benefit me. I find it hard to care about my work and it's taking a toll on my overall well-being. To cope, I've resorted to job hopping, typically leaving a position after around 18 months. I sometimes take breaks between jobs, living off my savings, and during these periods, my energy levels and outlook improve significantly. However, I realize this isn't a sustainable solution. I'm getting older, my resume is becoming cluttered, and I'd like to save money for a house in the future instead of depleting my savings between jobs. How can I overcome the cycle of work burnout and become better at navigating my professional life? Sincerely, burned out and seeking balance.
I mean, I hear this all the time, and usually these are jobs that are driven by the monetary compensation. Mm-hmm. And in the education world, they'll talk about intrinsic versus extrinsic motivation. Mm-hmm. So like the extrinsic motivation is the money, right? Like you need the money to have a nice apartment, to, you know, have things, but the intrinsic motivation isn't there. So no matter what you do, if you're going after a job just to pay the bills, someone like this may get burned out.
That is so wise. I love that you went there because right now there is a big conversation with young people, you know, just find a job that you can do the bare minimum and go home. And I'm like, that's fine, but that will burn you out. Because you can say, oh, you know, capitalism, dream job doesn't exist. Like we're all just corporate cogs all you want. But at the end of the day, if you're passionate, even just a little bit about what you're doing and you find meaning and you feel like you're making the world a better place, there is science that backs up that that will make you feel better and will improve your mental health. So I like that you went there. I think that's something we need to be talking about more often, that, you know, loving your job isn't a bad thing and you can be very passionate as you're passionate about what you do and I'm passionate about what I do. And it really doesn't make it feel like work all the time, at least.
And I mean, work is work. So it's great that the person has all those other things outside of work. So if they can try and find a job within an industry that they are passionate about, that's probably the best way to go because it's not just about the people that, you know, you're helping on the job, but it's the people that you're around. So if you're around like-minded people, that doesn't feel like work, you know?
It's so true. I always tell people, like, you know, the kids that entered the workforce post-COVID, they haven't had a lot of experience in the work, in like a normal workplace. And I think back to before COVID, going into an office and genuinely being friends with my coworkers, looking up to my boss as a mentor, eating snacks. I would bring my dog in, like, it was really fun. It can be fun to go to work.
Yeah.
And obviously not every day is going to be a blast, but like it's really cool when it's fun. So,
well, during the pandemic, my lab stayed open and because we were doing these studies that were monitored by the FDA. And so we had to cycle when people came in and like people would come in my team and they'd be like, thank God I came to the office. Like I was home, like going crazy. So, you know, it could be a community for you. If you're going through something bad at home, work can actually be a respite. Mm-hmm. So not everyone feels that way about work. Some people look forward to it.
Yeah. Yeah. Lucky them. No, just kidding. Well, thank you so much for coming in today. Now, how can people follow and support you and link up with you?
So I'm online, Dr. Judith Joseph on TikTok and IG. And my website is Dr. Judith Joseph. And follow me, sign up for my newsletter. I give a lot of tips, and I have a podcast as well, The Vault, and I give long form advice.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming in. I'm looking forward to your book too next year, which will be fantastic. And your research. I'm looking forward to you, you know, publishing more stuff and discovering more about our brains. I think you're doing some really, really important work. And yeah, it was a pleasure talking to you today.
Thank you for having me. It was so nice to meet you. We have access to work whenever we want. And I think that's a bad thing. Mm-hmm. So we have to be mindful to limit it. There's no need for you to be checking your emails when you're not at work. So I think burnout happens because work is just literally anywhere you want it to be. You could be on a beach in Bali and you still have access to work. That wasn't the case 30 years ago.
You could actually take a day off and no one could reach you. And now it's like, well, they can reach you, and they can reach you for just a tiny little thing. Mm-hmm.